Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
I read this book on holiday last year, end of the year, and I was really taken with it because it does cover everything from a bar mitzvah through to Davos, you know, and it manages to handle that. I think you did an amazing job of being able to sort of bring some central themes. And as you said, as you ended, a key central theme was purpose, mm-hmm. you know. But if we start, I realise that there are definitely events and we work, you know, I've been to hundreds of these events because I often sit here. And we do really know, I mean, you guys are the most amazing events team and incredibly professional in how we do things. So I do have a sort of strong sense of the purpose of what we're doing here. And the idea is it's wonderful. It makes your heart sing when someone says, I come here because the RSA's got inspirational speakers. You go, yay, we did stuff good. But actually, I never think about a party. I invite people over to my house. I say, come around 3, and then they go, what time did you want me? And I go, I don't know, I can't remember, what did the text say? And then they come late, I say, maybe come with children, maybe don't, I don't know, you could bring a puppy if you want. And then it ends up all over the place, and I go to bed when there's still lots of people there, mm-hmm. and I don't honour and awe anyone, and most of the time I'm sort of upstairs going, I hope it's going all right. So it was a real sort of, it really shook me a little bit to actually say, you should be present in all of these spaces. You know, these purposes arise everywhere. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you do go in the book to a range of different personal connections, you know, your kind of fitness group and this experiential going to places group that I can't remember what it's called.
I'm here today.
Yeah, and they're all really beautiful in their purposes. Could you expand a little bit on
sure.
some of those?
Sure. I mean, the first thing I'll say is having a purpose to your gathering need not make your gathering formal, right? People ask me, like, do you just Netflix and chill? It's like, yes, I just Netflix and chill. And I know of many, I know of a host who purposely gathers people and then goes upstairs and takes a nap. And it really works. It works for her and it works for us. In part, but so it's not saying that all of a sudden you need to become formal with your friends. So please don't misunderstand that. It's really asking from the beginning that life is short, time is short. If you have children, like the time that you have with others is short and sometimes very distracted. And it's simply asking first, how do I want to spend time with these people? And what is the best way to do that? Having people come over at 3 p.m. and, you know, all hanging out with your close friends is completely fine. I think what I am really talking about is when you want to have a more meaningful gathering with your friends or any type of group, there are ways to increase the level of meaning, and that's by increasing the level of focus. Mm-hmm. And so I'll give an example. I was speaking with a woman who... is a journalist, and she was actually, the Art of Gathering came out in the US in May last year, in 2018, and she was assigned by Real Simple Magazine to do a piece on how to Art of Gatherify her dinner party. So she called me up, and I think she thought I was going to say, like, put your fish knives this way, and put the wine glass here, and Georgian wine is all the rage. And I said, well, what is a need in your life right now that by bringing a specific group of people you might address? And she said, for a dinner party? I said, just work with me here. And she said, well, I'm a worn out mom. The other day I was at a friend's house. She cut me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich into triangles. She fed me and I burst into tears. And I said, why did you burst into tears? And she said, because I realized that how worn out I am and how beautiful it was to feel taken care of in that moment. And she said, what if I hosted a dinner party for my other worn out moms? And I said, that's great. Give it a name, right? Make it seeable. The Worn Out Mom's Hootenanny. Give it a rule. If you talk about your kids, you have to take a shot. And she started getting excited, and I could hear her on the phone, like, oh, I see what you mean. Oh, so what do I do? Do I send a paperless poster or an invite? And I said, just put it in an email. Make it embodied. You're worn out. Put Worn Out Mom Hootenanny in the subject line. Tell the peanut butter and jelly story sandwich. Give them context to your life. Invite the other worn out moms in your life. And she did this, and all 6 women RSVP'd yes within the first 45 minutes. And she's like, I've never had response rates like this. And they did takeout. They did not cook, right? It was embodied all the way through. When they walked in, she thought about the opening ritual, and she didn't call it that, but when each woman walked in, we thought up this idea. She had them rummage through their purse and take out anything child-related and put in a basket. So these disgusting old gummy bears, packs, half-eaten packs. And it was this joyous, hilarious, beautiful, soul-filling night. And it's just taking your real life and not pretending it's not your life. It's actually saying, this is my life, right? This is not a be formal and don't open the kimono. This is actually this is real. My life is this right now. I feel like having a birthday party this year. A lot of adults no longer have birthday parties. Why? Because I think most of us don't feel like we need to have people come together and blow out candles for us, right? Mm. But that's because we assume a specific format in our head of what a birthday party has to look like. If in fact you still ask the same question, what is a need in my life right now that by bringing a specific group of people together, I could use my birthday as an excuse to market, what might that be? I want to be more adventurous. I have a friend who recently turned 50, and his opening toast for this night was, I realize that in my life I've watched people become 50 and 60 and 70, and most people contract. They have less friends, they take less adventures, they read less, and there's a few people in my life who expand. They keep making friends, they keep discovering new people, and you are here because you are the people who expand. And I'm not over 50, but yeah. And in that moment, he oriented us, he connected us, he helped us see what he most wanted in his life. He allows us in years later, when he starts contracting, to say, hey, remember Adam, you said you wanted to expand. He used that as a moment to honor us, but to also say, hey, keep me accountable to what I say I want to do and then get lazy. So part of this gathering is not so much saying become tight and closed and anal, I don't know, sorry, live stream, become extremely rigid. No. It's saying what is the need right now around which I'm willing to show you my need and invite you in to basically create something new together, to mark, to witness, to remember, to invent, rather than saying, let's come together, be in the living room and blow out birthday candles. You can still have a cake, right? But it's more starting with the need, not with the format.
It's so interesting as you came here and you brought the fact that we are a British audience largely, and how we might feel a bit uncomfortable with the honouring and awing. And you actually enabled people to stand up and honour each other here. I'd love to know a little bit more. My mother's American, so I have a very polarised situation in my house too, in that as I grew up, my dad is from Salford and my mum's from New York. And that means that I am always in this sort of space as well, where my mum is very comfortable honouring and my dad is like, oh my God, what just happened? The troublemaker and the smoother over. How do you approach different cultures with that honouring and awing?
That's a great question. I think of every gathering as a social contract, which basically means it is an agreement between that promise of as a host of what it is you're going to provide, both materially and psychologically, and an actual opportunity to say yes. Yes, I am willing to receive that as a guest. Yes, I am willing to take that risk as a guest. And I think many of our, and that's true across cultures. And I think many of us, whether it's you live in London or live in New York like me, or in many cities around the world, they're getting more and more multicultural. So we all have different ways of gathering, right? And a huge part of, I think, the reason why, whether you are introverted or extroverted, or whether you are honoring forward or honoring recessive or whatever you want to call it, is we're not often, we are vague in our invitations, and so we don't actually represent what it is we want to do in an evening. So even if you take that simple example of the worn-out mom's hootenanny, if she had said, come to my dinner party, and they walked in and said, okay, it's a worn-out mom's hootenanny, and you get a shot, and you get a shot, and you get a shot, and people might resist and say, well, I didn't sign up for this, I don't want to drink on a Tuesday, or I don't want it, right? And part of what she was doing in naming the invitation was she moved up the social contract. So that by saying, this is what this is, do you want to come? And giving people real choices to come in. I'll give an example. My stepfather is English, and he finds some of the formats that I use, uncomfortable. And there's been contexts in which when it's set up and he knows that it's going to happen, he then has a real choice of whether he wants to come in and actually do a 15 toasts in a family dinner or not. And I'll just pause. I want to actually come back to that story in a second. But when I spring it on people, when I, you know, as a guest, I believe you have a lot of power. You go to a dinner and then people are kind of talking on the side, or it's a conference and you bring together five people and say, hey, let's go get a drink. And then people are just chit-chatting about, and you really want to say, like, hey, why don't we have a focus? Right? So it's not always planned. But so I'll give an example. 6 or 7 years ago, my husband and I got married in India. And I'm half Indian, and he's Indian-American. And we went back for the first time to India to meet our families, our extended families. And we wanted to see everybody. But we knew that the context of our family culture was that if we just got everyone together for dinner, the cousins would talk to the cousins, the uncles would talk to the uncles, both sides would kind of keep to themselves after the formalities. And we really wanted to have a different kind of night. But we needed to warn them. So we built our allies. We called his grandmother and we called my mother and we said, what do you think if we did this 15 toast model for our whole family? And my grandmother-in-law said, like, basically, like, I think it's a beautiful idea. And we're like, okay, check. So then we started, we did it in like a neutral area. It wasn't on either person's house. And invited everybody and said, we're going to do a different kind of night. It's called 15 Toasts. Get ready to share a story. And so everyone knew what they were coming for. And they behaved in part because of each other, right? The other family kept them on their best behavior. And at the beginning of the night, we dung our glass and we said, tell us a story of some time in your life in which a story or an experience from your life that no one around the table has ever heard, and how it affected your lens on the world. And for 3 hours, and to their credit, they were game, and they told stories, and we heard stories like my grandmother, who is now 92 and rarely speaks, she spoke in Hindi, I did it through translation, who was one of the first women to go to Banaras University, Banaras Hindu University, and how she went in a covered-up carriage with a blanket, and her father said that she should go and apply, but he was going to go out of town to be at a cousin's wedding and purposely wasn't going to be in town when all the families complained, so he could pretend that he didn't know. And then we said, so Nani, how did that change your view? And she said, I understood how change happens. And we said, why? And she said, well, for me, I understood that change can't happen without at least some of the powerful consenting to it. I'd never heard my grandmother say that. And in that room, you see this sort of old, frail, Hindi-speaking woman, and you think all sorts of things, and you realize in that moment, you think, wow, what a pioneer, right? So part of this, and all everyone was willing to do it because we set them up to understand that this is what this thing was. I think a lot of the pushback and a lot of the terror comes when you spring things on people or when the purpose is illegitimate, right? Like, why are we doing this? This doesn't make any sense. So if you remember nothing else from today, think about how you prime your guests. Think about naming your invitations in ways that, you know, even in a work meeting, is it a brainstorming? Is it a laboratory? Is it a workshop? Is it a why did last quarter stink so bad? Right? And if you make your title, your name of your gathering, do your work for you, or you're actually then bringing people in, so you're priming them in a way where they already know what they're going to be talking about. I have a friend, an acquaintance who hosts dinner parties in salons in Los Angeles, and before every salon, he has these five rules, and it's like, you have to come on time, please bring wine, it's rude not to, like very explicit, and no small talk. And then he attaches a piece by Dan Ariely from Wired magazine of the science of small talk and why it's actually preventing disconnection. So he legitimized the argument by having, you know, a Harvard professor say like something that's very obvious to all of us. But you can talk about whatever you want, but you can't talk about the traffic, which is apparently what a lot of people in LA talk about. You can't talk about how you got here, which route you took. You can't talk about the weather. You have to figure out what to say. And so he's priming people ahead of time, and we tend to under-host because we think the gathering begins when people walk in the door. But the gathering begins at the moment of discovery, and you're hosting people all the way through to the moment they walk in. And if you do that well, there's much less to facilitate in the room because people already are kind of on board for what it is you want to be doing.
Amazing. I'm going to open up to the audience. So if you have a question for Priya.
Thank you. My question is, I had a theory which I developed a few years ago about when people first meet someone they haven't met before, in 90% of cases, they find out 90% of what they need to know within the first 90 seconds of talking to them. And just wondering whether, what you think of that?
I mean, I think Blink is kind of the, you know, Malcolm Gladwell's book is a lot about that, which is sort of the instinctual judgments we make in a second, and how does our behavior reflect that judgment? And to me, I think one of the elements of gatherings is whether it's within 90 seconds, or often whether it's within the people we think we know, right? The team that we've known for 20 years, the family that we've known for 20 years. I actually think the deeper danger is when we see the same people every single day and we think we know everything about them, right? And part of gathering in ways that are refreshing and asking, you know, whether it's this 15 toast model with my family, is figuring out how do you have fascinating conversation, not just with strangers who don't have kind of a dog in the fight of your life, with the people that you see every day. And I think part of the danger of whether that's true or not, I'm not a scientist, I couldn't tell you, is that when we think we know people, we fall into scripts. And scripts are the death of gatherings. When we think we know people, we fall into roles. And when you fall into the same role over and over again, it's very difficult to get unstuck. So David Cantor is a sociologist who does a lot of work with team dynamics. And 30 years ago or so, he and his team wired up a group of families with their permission all around their house and recorded hundreds of hours of their conversation over the course of a week. Everything, bedroom, bathroom, kitchen. And they listened to the dynamics to see what happens in families. And he says, in every family, in every system, there's usually four roles in any conversation. There's the leader. Hey, let's go to Chinese tonight. There's the follower. That's a great idea. There's the opposer. Ah, we do Chinese all the time. And there's the observer, sort of stay quiet and see what's happening. And he says, in healthy families, those roles exist regardless, but they rotate. Sometimes it's the mom suggesting where they should go, sometimes it's the younger brother, sometimes it's the aunt. In unhealthy families, they're stuck. The leader's always the leader, the opposer's always the opposer, and so on. And so a huge part of your gatherings is how do you create gatherings, whether it's changing the room, so rooms come with scripts. If you're doing an offsite and you want a board to change up, don't sit at the same table you always sit at, or simply switch the chairs. Hey, that's always my chair, not today, right? And so finding certain ways to get people off their scripts so that we have more curiosity about one another, because there's always more to discover.
Absolutely. The lady there.
I had to. Thank you very much, Priya, for having me. The question I had is about, I think what you're fundamentally doing is going against the grain of what actually the rest of society is doing. We're rushing into our phones and technology and AI, and you're talking about a very human thing, people-to-people connection. I think you're not talking about iPhones gathering together. So how do you deal with this challenge of technology and gathering when there's a whole community online that's gathering simultaneously while you're having a chat with someone at a dinner party? How do you deal with that conflict?
That's a great question. And Ranu Sinha is one of my oldest fellow gatherers. And if you can imagine a night when we were both 24 years old in New Delhi, deciding we're going to stay longer in India and have a massive joint birthday party to mark the occasion, she is that. So a couple of things. First is, I think many of these principles are deeply relevant for online gatherings. Right? And we are gathering online more and more and more. I think a lot of the problems Facebook is facing, Twitter is facing, is that the tools and the algorithms that were built weren't built in mind with a specific social contract, or weren't clear on what the purpose actually was. And they're now kind of backtracking to realize, well, what is this for? Is this for many people in multiple contexts? What does it mean to protect our guests? What does it mean to equalize our guests? Can we connect when something's being deeply manipulated? So I think these online gatherings are as relevant of how do you open? What are the conditions for entry? How and when do you get kicked out? How can you create a gathering online on a Facebook group that's timed, right? What's an hour Facebook group versus one that's just continually on? But offline, our phones are deeply distracting. And I think the best ways is to be playful with it and to invent some rules. So in one of the chapters, I talk about pop-up rules. And some of the best ones I know One is called the phone stack rule, where it was invented by a dancer in Los Angeles, where he was realizing he was going out with his friends and everyone was excited to go out, and then they'd sit and literally be like this on the phone the whole time. And rather than kind of coming in and correcting, he said, okay, I'm going to try a rule here. Everyone has to stack their phone in the middle of the table, and the first person to look at their phone foots the bill. All right, so it's finding playful ways. None of us really want to fully be on our phone, but we are addicted, right? There's thousands and thousands of engineers who have spent a lot of time wanting to make sure that we see, oh, do I have 23 Instagram likes? 37 Instagram likes? Versus actually being here. And so to have etiquette is not strong enough for the engineering that has gone into making us addicted to this. And so rules are a way, pop-up rules that are legitimate, are ways to get people off of their phones. A more extreme example that you mentioned earlier that my husband and I used to do before we had children was called I Am Here Days, which is we moved to New York. We wanted to explore the neighborhoods. We were told that when you move to New York, you get kind of, it may be like this in London, you get kind of stuck in the one or two neighborhoods that you live in, that you work in, that your friends are in. And so every once a month on a Saturday or a Sunday, we would go to a neighborhood for 12 hours, turn our phones off with two or three or six other friends, and explore the area on foot. And it kind of grew, a lot of our friends were interested in it, and it evolved over time and developed these organic rules. And the rules were you have to turn off your phone, you have to be here all 12 hours, come on time, leave for the entire experience. No micro-coordinating, no, someone can't casually drop in at 2 p.m. because why? All of a sudden at noon you're looking at your phone, oh, I don't know, where are we gonna be, how are we gonna be? It blocks spontaneity. And whenever we have a meal, it's one conversation. And what happened there? A couple of things. First, we were off our phones, but we realized that spending 12 hours together was fundamentally different than spending 3 hours together four times. Because every gathering, whether it's 90 minutes or whether it's 2 days, has an arc. It has an opening, and then it has a peak, and then you kind of like fall. 3 p.m., we'd always kind of fall. People would get really cranky, and then they started getting real. We'd take naps in parks, we'd wake up, and almost always at 5 or 6 p.m., there'd be this sort of new rise, and all of a sudden, there's this deep vulnerability. Whoever was there, whether it was friends or strangers who were coming in for the first time, we'd worn each other out, and so we'd start getting real. And the tighter we'd make these rules, particularly around the phones, the more these spread around the city. And so don't be afraid don't be a chill host. Like, make rules around phones, but get people to buy into it in ways that they realize, like, this is for a greater good, right? So it's like using your power not to be controlling, using your power to protect the group to be able to actually meet your purpose.
Thank you. Time has gone faster than it normally does. It's amazing. And so we have reached, unfortunately, the end of time of this event, obviously not of the end of time. But it'd be great if we, you know, to be here with you would be probably appropriate. Thank you so much. Now, one of Priya's rules is logistics never end a session, because that's just a dreadful way to end. So I'll do some logistics now, which is there will be a book signing outside. And there is the Rothmells Bar is open downstairs, and that we have a fellowship gathering downstairs applying Priya's rules, which probably means that you're not allowed to join them. But they'll be somewhere there. You can go and try and spot them. Time has flown, and it's been really, really enjoyable to be with you. And I would highly recommend Priya's book, but I will hand over to Priya to end well and elegantly.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me. And one of my rules is never begin with logistics and never end with logistics. Do them second to last, in part because the audience attention is highest in the first few moments and highest towards the end, right? Oh, I'm ready to get out of here. Ooh, that drink. Ooh, let me, right? And so don't outsource it to where the car park is. End with what you want people to remember. And what I would most want you to remember, and thank you for having me, is first to leave today, and if you could do me one honor, which is to gather boldly in some part of your life. Pick a future gathering, whether it's personal or work, and think about how would you do it in a way if you're going to reimagine it. And then email me about it. You can find me on priyaparker.com and just email into the link. And tell me your stories. Because I think part of this is about culture change. And I want to get to a point where if you walk in and people start with logistics, half the room laughs, right? It's like, how do you begin to change? People start with listening and realize, like, oh, this person has no purpose. Uh-oh, right? Like, I want to create social pressure to begin to have more meaning. right? Social pressure exists around all sorts of stuff. I want social pressure to make us all demand better gatherings from each other, which that can also mean more relaxed gatherings, right? It does not mean more formal. So finally, I will end in text, which is my table of contents, which is what I would most want you all to remember, and thank you for having me. First, decide why you're really gathering. Second, close doors. Third, don't be a chill host. Fourth, create a temporary alternative world. Fifth, never start a funeral with logistics. Sixth, keep your best self out of my gathering. Seven, cause good controversy. And eight, and I thank you for having me, accept that there is an end. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.